Welcome, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. It's our Friday Media Roundtable, and there is a lot to talk about. Earlier this week, journalist James Foley was brutally executed on video by the Islamic State. There's huge controversy over whether media outlets should show the video. And there are increasing cries for the U.S. to take action to stop the growing power of the Islamic State. Here in the U.S., the protests and police response in Ferguson dominated the week's news after 18-year-old Michael Brown was killed by police officer Darren Wilson on August 9th. The chasm between a largely white police force and the mostly black population of Ferguson was sharply revealed. Attorney General Eric Holder visited Missouri this week and said, "I understand that mistrust." There have been allegations that media representatives have made the story too much about them and questions over police treatment of journalists and protesters alike. And Mexico has become one of the most dangerous countries for journalists. Our guest traces the roots of that growing conflict where more than 100,000 people have either died or disappeared since 2006. Alfredo Corchado is a reporter with the Dallas Morning News, and he's the author of Midnight in Mexico, a reporter's journey through a country's descent into darkness. Hi, Alfredo.
Hi, Holly. Thanks. Good to be with you.
Good to have you here. We're also joined from St. Louis by Chris King. He's the editorial director of the St. Louis American, which is the only local African-American newspaper continuously published since 1928 and the longest continually published weekly newspaper in the St. Louis area. Hi, Chris.
Hello there.
Good to have you both here. And as you know, on Fridays, we start the show by giving kudos to a journalist or an outlet that has done a good job this week. So let's start with you, Alfredo. What's your recommendation for a good piece of journalism for us?
Well, I love reading Cindy Carcamo's piece this week. Cindy's with the LA Times, and she was actually able to go back to Honduras and do a piece on what happens to immigrants who are deported back to Honduras, people who are deported back from the U.S. It's an important story, and I was just glad to see that Cindy continues to follow it from both sides of the border. It's been a week of great journalism also. A piece by the Univision and Fusion. They got a rare interview with a smuggler who gave the viewer a step-by-step look at what happens, how much money they charge, who they pay to get people from Central America into the United States. It was quite fascinating.
So really an in-depth look into how it happens.
Exactly.
And you did a great piece yourself earlier this month on La Bestia, the beast, the train that takes so many kids and people here.
Well, thank you. And we have a second piece that runs this weekend. So that we're just trying to give American readers a sense of the journey from San Pedro Sula through Guatemala and on through Mexico.
Well, we'll put links to all of that at yourcallradio.org. And Chris, let's turn to you. What do you want to give a shout-out to this week?
Well, Chris Cuomo on CNN New Day was the first person that ran with the story we had from the beginning, that outside instigators were being allowed to start the worst of the violence that the police then responded to with militarized force. Once CNN covered the story, respectfully, everybody did, more or less, and that was the turning point in demilitarizing the conflict, because we finally got the police to arrest these individuals that had been right there in front of them the entire time.
Well, that's great, and there's an interesting article, actually, in today's Chronicle here in the Bay Area. It's a report out by UC Berkeley talking about how police tactics can really escalate conflicts or de-escalate them. And again, we'll put links to all of that at yourcallradio.org, and we'll talk a lot more about Ferguson in just a moment, Chris. But another big, big story this week was the beheading of James Foley on tape, which brings up the issue of when do you withhold information from the public and when do you publish or broadcast it. And I'm wondering, Alfredo, what you think about that, because I know that this is an issue in Mexico, too. You've written about it in your book, where brutal violence can really be a tool of propaganda.
Right. Mexico is one of the most dangerous countries to practice journalism. And it's almost a sense that the cartels, in some ways mimicking acts in the Middle East, have taken to targeting journalists, holding them hostage, trying to silence them, and by doing that, they control communities. So it's something that we've seen with a lot of Mexican colleagues. I mean, more than 80, some people say more than 100 journalists have been killed or disappeared in the last 6-7 years. So it's something that you see what happened to our colleague James Foley, and it just brings the issue home. I think for some of us, it makes you question, you know, it makes you question our love for and passion for journalism. And I think in my case, it just adds to the commitment of trying to tell these stories, because you want to believe, you continue to believe that stories can make a difference.
Well, and you yourself write about receiving death threats and how that affects the work that you do.
Right. I mean, I think when I first received my threat, or the last threat in July of 2007, I mean, my initial response was to try to find out who was behind it, how serious were they, what were they looking for, and in a way try to reach out to them. I eventually left Mexico thinking I was through with Mexico and I was through with the story. But I think in getting away from the story, it only made me come back. I mean, it made me feel that much more responsible. Like, I think as an American journalist, I mean, there's a difference in American journalists in the Middle East to a journalist in Mexico. I mean, I think in Mexico, American journalists are much more perceived as radioactive. You don't really want to touch them. It doesn't mean that it won't happen, but I think there's much more, let's think twice about this, whereas in the Middle East, it's much more of a political situation, so a journalist becomes a political commodity. And that's a huge, huge difference. I mean, what I face, the dangers I face, really pale in comparison to what my colleagues in Mexico face.
And Chris, let's talk about all the attention that Ferguson is getting following the killing of Michael Brown. You wrote really elegantly about the economic disenfranchisement and the decline of the suburban rings around St. Louis. Can you tell us a little bit more about Ferguson and the people who live there and what it's like?
Well, Ferguson doesn't have a great identity in the St. Louis region. We consider it part of St. Louis County, North County. North part of the county is very black, you know, diverse but black. North part of the city of St. Louis, which is a very small political entity that's segregated from the county. Again, the North City's black and the South City's white. So we have quite racially polarized demographics, but this one really hasn't been a racially polarized experience, except for the fact that black men are invariably the people who die unarmed when police kill someone who's unarmed. And so people, but a lot of different kinds of people rose up with the initial protesters who came out of a couple of sort of low-income housing developments in Ferguson. But in general, it's really considered part of North County, which is a diverse county in a very interesting place. And Ferguson's a very nice place, by the way. The apartment complex where Michael Brown was left to die, and he left was laid on the street for 4 hours in plain view of his family and friends. The police wouldn't let them near, and that's really what drove people out of their mind with rage. But a lot of people all over the region stood up with the individuals of Canfield and North Winds, which were the apartment areas. And I feel more people are going to be coming into those areas from the outside with good intentions, rather than the police who came in with military force with very bad intentions and opened fire on residents in their backyards with tear gas canisters. I mean, we saw some of the craziest things. The worst paranoid nightmares you could conjure, we saw it with our own eyes shot in our backyard on national TV.
How did Ferguson become so segregated? According to a recent report by the Brookings Institute, the social and economic inequality in the St. Louis area is a really a microcosm of this issue all across the U.S., that wealthier, often white residents move into previously economically disadvantaged or move out of these neighborhoods, and they can also price out black families and displace them to other areas. You wrote about this recently. Can you tell us just a little bit about that?
Well, yeah, I mean, there is white flight, let's face it, and that's another place where race is present in this story. Race is really not the first thing that happened here, although it's a background for everything. I mean, if you have more affluent people who are mostly white leaving areas, if any black family moves in, then, of course, you're going to end up with majority black families. And in a region where there's such a large income disparity by race, an all-black neighborhood, on average, will be lower income than an all-white neighborhood. And when this is compounded for decades without any political leadership, or really on either side of the spectrum, I mean, our newspapers called for decades for the basically white economic leadership to step up, invest more. And our argument from the beginning is it's for the best interest of our region. This is not charity. You know, don't empower black communities to feel good about it. Empower black communities because we need people to be invested in this system for the system to even function peaceably, let alone thrive. I mean, we've seen a complete breakdown in our social fabric, a militarization of our neighborhoods based upon the fact that one particular community was so disenfranchised that when they rose up in protest, the fire was pretty hot in their hearts.
And Alfredo, what do you see as the parallels between that historic economic disenfranchisement and the same kind of issues in Mexico, the growing violence and power vacuum? I think I read in your book, or maybe it was an article that you wrote, you said weak institutions allow criminals to take the country hostage.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you have a country of 100 million people, 120 million people now, where less than 10% of the country really controls the political destiny, the economic destiny. So you have many, many disenfranchised people. The drug war in Mexico started, late 90s, early 2000, 2001, 2002. And it also hit its peak during a time when you had this world economic crisis, which only forced more people. I mean, as the U.S.-Mexican economy has become much more intertwined, the United States sneezes and Mexico catches a cold, or vice versa. So you saw the impact, the economic impact in Mexico. You saw the rise of what was known as Los Ninis, what is known as Los Ninis, people who don't study, people who don't go to school, people who don't have jobs. Many of these people became much, much more vulnerable to becoming targets of the cartels. And thus you had, you still to this day have this huge population of very young people who go into cartels knowing that they're not going to live that long. I mean, I think the average age for a person in a cartel, something like 30 years old. And then that's why, you know, a lot of these young kids, they gravitate towards to this lifestyle, you know, the corridos, the flashy vehicles, the flashy dress style and so forth. They know they have a short life, but that's a real, I think, reflection of the kind of economic inequality there is in Mexico to this day.
And that's Alfredo Corchado. He's the Mexican Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News and the author of Midnight in Mexico, A Reporter's Journey Through a Country's Descent into Darkness. It's about his professional and personal journey in the U.S. and Mexico. Chris King is editorial director of the St. Louis American, which is the only local African-American newspaper continuously published since 1928. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and it's our Friday Media Roundtable, and I want to invite you to join our conversation about coverage of the week's news. The number is 866-798-8255. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-TALK. You can also email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. And we're wondering what grabbed your attention about the coverage of Ferguson. What do you think has been good? What's disappointed you? Is the media attention opening up a dialogue about race and police relations in the U.S.? And what do you want to ask our guests? And what do you see as the parallels between the militarization of U.S. police forces and our drug war in Latin America, as well as the exodus of refugees fleeing the violence in places like Honduras and El Salvador? The number again to join our conversation is 866-798-8255. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-TALK, or email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Chris, I've heard and read that in the last 2 days, especially as the protests have wound down, the National Guard is leaving, that there's almost more media than protesters. And there's been a lot of criticism of media. A freelancer with Al Jazeera America was saying that media were being disrespectful, yelling at residents if they were getting in the way of good shots. Yelling at residents in public meetings to stay on mic, making small talk and laughing at the spot where Mike Brown was killed. There's an article or a blog by Ryan Schussler saying, "I will not be returning to Ferguson because journalists are making this story about them."
Well, That's all true. There's more to be said about it, but it is all true. I've tried to get a lot of local residents in front of cameras and failed to some extent. The local residents that started the movement and suffered from it the most really were strangely not at the center of it. And journalists did get a lot of attention. I was interviewed by the Poynter Institute of Journalism, and that was my one complaint about coverage, was that everyone overdid the journalist story when a couple guys were arrested at a McDonald's where people were using to file stories and charge their batteries. I mean, you know, we had militarized police firing tear gas canisters into people's backyards when they weren't even at the protest. You know, you had people gassing sidewalks where there were small children, and they weren't doing anything. They were just there. So that story, oddly, didn't get out, as well as the fact that a couple of journalists were arrested at a McDonald's. But, you know, the media were fired on, and they should have felt like targets. And I'm glad people did come cover the story and put it out over the world. So I'm grateful they came, and when they leave, I'll and partly be sorry to see them go.
Do you feel like there are, I mean, there's been so much coverage this week, but do you feel like there are aspects of what has been happening over the last 2 weeks that haven't been covered in mainstream media?
Absolutely, and I'm working on getting that story out very diligently. We're a community newspaper and an advocacy newspaper, and I personally was in the military as a young man, so I had a lot of insight into what was happening and was able to work somewhat under the ground in some cases to explain to people what were going on and to get the police authorities to engage with the community. You have to understand, initially, the police command didn't even have police intelligence on the streets at night, and which is where, when the outside instigators were coming into the community. So I worked very hard with others to change the police command to the Missouri State Highway Patrol, and that enabled some people that joined the Unified Command did have intelligence officers working at night. They'd already been there, and so we were able to communicate the street intelligence to the police intelligence, and that's exactly when the outside instigators were arrested en masse and exactly when things got safer. And I am hoping that someone will help me tell that story in great detail, because we had a community policing movement that united with a police intelligence movement that came into the protest late. And if from the beginning the police had sincerely wanted to stop this protest peacefully, they could have done it with good intelligence work. That's a story that should be told.
And do you feel like that the police are being characterized fairly?
It's a long story. It's still evolving. I don't understand right now how a militarized police presence could let in the instigators that came in. I don't see how they got in. I had journalists that couldn't get past checkpoints when they live half a mile away, and yet people from Chicago with Molotov cocktails and grenades that never emerged for use, but I had an embedded photographer friend of mine who saw the grenades, and when I told that to the police command, that seemed to help get them moving to make some arrests. We don't exactly still know how these instigators got in and stayed there so long when they were in plain view. I mean, they weren't hiding themselves once they were there. Molotov cocktail, you never heard that said in St. Louis County before this event, and yet some folks came in, showed some angry young folks who were there how to make them. It's an easy technology. And how that all happened under the watch of this huge military command is a story that needs to be told, and I don't exactly yet understand it, but we're trying.
And Chris, one of the things that's striking as well about this story is the huge chasm between how people look at what happened to Michael Brown and the protests in Ferguson and the police response. And it often seems to be seen through prisms of race and lacking kind of this historical context that we've been talking about. What's your thought on that chasm and how you bridge it?
Well, it's very simple. I mean, if you're a middle-class white person, you have to do something very wrong to be antagonized by the police. I mean, that's just the way it is. I happen to be a middle-class white person working for a black newspaper. And unless I stand up with the black community when they protest, the police aren't going to bother me for the most part, or if I break the law. But if you're an African-American man, particularly in this region but all over this country, simply by being a black man, you can be targeted by the police. We've seen this over and over again. So, of course, if the police aren't on you, and you see how viciously the police respond when you protest what they do, it's very tempting to say, well, that's a black thing, and that's not in my neighborhood. And it's very tempting. I could see why people don't want to get bothered with it.
And it's their fault. It's not happening to me, so they must be doing something differently.
Well, that's the outside instigator produced that narrative because they brought the violence that inspired the police protest. I mean, the people in the area were very, very angry. And without these instigators that escalated the conflict for the military police to respond to, there would have been local news, maybe a blip of national news. But this SWAT team militarized environment, that was provoked. And we're just now getting back almost somewhere close to normal, where we can go back to where we started, which was asking for more information about a police-involved shooting. The officer's innocent until proven guilty, but there seems to be enough evidence, in my view, to at least bring charges against him. That would satisfy the community to a great deal to know that the officer was just treated with the basics of criminal justice, which is if you put six bullets into someone in the middle of the day who's unarmed, you should be charged and then have your day in court. You know, I don't expect this police shooter would be convicted by a jury in St. Louis County. It's hard to imagine that he would, but it would do a great deal of calm for our community if just the basic elements of criminal justice were brought to bear on this individual, despite the fact that he is a police officer.
And Alfredo, what stands out for you in terms of both how national and international media outlets are covering Ferguson?
Well, it's been interesting. I mean, I'm based in Mexico, and it really has been the story that's led many of the Mexican papers throughout the week. I also have a very good friend who's the editor at the San Luis Post-Dispatch, so I've been keeping in touch with them, and just seeing how that story really, I mean, it's not Ferguson. It's really communities across the country that face very similar situations. Where you know the demographic shift may have moved one way or the other way, but you still have many people stuck in poverty or people whose voices aren't heard, and then something like this happens, and you have police who are not that sensitive to the situation.
And how much do each of you feel like translators for your audiences? Chris, in a way, you're a bridge between mainstream media and community media, and Alfredo, you're literally translating for an audience.
Well, on my part, I spent a lot of time helping outside media get grounded here and putting out into the community the names of organizers. Our newspaper knows very well all the people that have been on the news nationally. We knew them before national news came here. Our daily paper, which my colleague just mentioned, don't much cover the black community. They do, but not. They don't know the people the way we do. They don't have a very. They're not very well represented on their journalism staff by African Americans, and their folks don't live in Ferguson. Like most of my folks live very near there. Most of our staff. So yes, we've definitely been translating. Of course, we do that all the time. It's just haven't been noticed by the mainstream quite as much before as we have now. And in that sense, we're grateful for the attention. I just wish it would have got it another way.
And are the suburbs of places like Clayton interested more in what's happening?
Yes. I mean, there's a lot of fear and dread. I mean, people don't want it to spread. Now, whether or not people are going to step outside of their comfort zones enough to engage with the community in a way to build the bridges that will stop it from happening again, I can't promise you that. I'm calling for people to strengthen their connections with new friends, new alliances. I would like for people to watch the outcome of the trial, if there is a trial, in integrated groups. You know, we need to move forward as a community, I would hope, without erupting into something that really should be described as a riot and really might almost merit more of a militarized response. I don't want us to go there, but you have to understand the people that have been suffered from police abuse all these years, you know, the tension's on now, and the hotter the pressure, the more the general community cares. So the people that just wanted to die down right away are probably the people that weren't suffering to begin with.
Although media attention does tend to have sort of ADD and just shift from the new, you know, to the latest, to the next story. Do
yes.
you think this one has more staying power nationally?
I don't know. We'll have to see.
Alfredo, I'm going to go to you right after a short break, just because we're not going to have time for you to get in on it, but I promise we'll go straight to you and then to callers. Alfredo Corchado is Mexican Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News and the author of Midnight in Mexico, A Reporter's Journey Through a Country's Descent into Darkness. Chris King is Editorial Director at the St. Louis American, and we're talking about media coverage of the week's news. We'll take your calls and hear more from both of our guests in just a minute. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. We'll be right back after a short break.
You're listening to Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW. To take part in today's conversation, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. 866-798-TALK. You can also shoot us an email if you prefer to write. The address is feedback@yourcallradio.org, or you can just leave your comment there anonymously at yourcallradio.org. www.bbc.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock, the BBC's World Have Your Say. Following that at noon, it's the Tavis Smiley Show. And at 1 o'clock this afternoon, Latino USA.
If you're just joining us now, it's our Friday Media Roundtable, and we're talking about the protest and police response in Ferguson following the killing of Michael Brown, an 18-year-old unarmed black man who was shot 6 times by a police officer. We're also talking about reporting on the war on drugs and how Mexico has become one of the most dangerous places in the world for journalists. I'm Holly Kernan, in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. That's also where you can post comments and join this conversation. On Monday, we'll be talking about the photo exhibition Envisioning Human Rights at UC Berkeley. It opens next Thursday, and it'll be showcasing the work of world-class photographers who will be sharing their images from Guatemala to Kosovo to the American South. Today, again, is our media roundtable, and we're joined by Chris King from St. Louis. He's the managing editor of the St. Louis American, and Alfredo Corchado, who's the Mexico bureau chief for the Dallas Morning News, and the author of Midnight in Mexico, A Reporter's Journey Through a Country's Descent into Darkness. The number to join our conversation is 866-798-8255. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. And Alfredo, I want to apologize. Before the break, you were going to talk about being a translator for your audiences, and you were going to respond to something that Chris had said.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, I mean, that's a great question, and what Chris was saying about how stories are hot one day and not hot the other, you know, the next day. I mean, that's kind of the story in Central America, that it's still going on, and it's something that I think Americans will be confronting for many years to come. But, I mean, to get back to your question, Holly, I was born in Mexico, raised in Central California, and then later Texas. So when I arrived in Mexico as a foreign correspondent, I thought, you know, I'm the perfect bridge, I'm the perfect translator for both countries. And I think to some extent, I mean, it's worked out that way. But I think you also, when you're a journalist of color, in my case, a Mexican-American, you also quickly understand that you really have to try harder to be that translator and to be that bridge. Mm-hmm. I mean, anytime I write a story that you put the word immigration, I mean, you're going to get bombarded by both sides. I do the stories on Central America and the Beast, and I can't recall the Dallas Morning News receiving more letters to the editor that day. I think it was over 200, maybe 300 letters that came in, mostly angry people, you know, saying, oh, you're too sympathetic, blah, blah. So it's just a reminder of how hard you have to work to be a translator, in this case, between two countries or two peoples.
And it was so interesting in your story about the Beast, this big train that takes so many Central Americans through the very arduous journey through Mexico, very dangerous. Can you just tell us a little bit more about La Bestia?
Yeah, La Bestia has been for generations. You know, there are two ways to get from Central America to the United States. I mean, two, I guess, principal ways. There may be others, but it's either through a smuggler, who you have to pay, you know, $4,000, $6,000. And when you talk about unaccompanied children, I mean, I think that's kind of a misperception, because a lot of these children, when you have relatives in the United States paying for them or family members, there are people who are accompanied by smugglers. And then you have the people who have no money, no documents. They gravitate toward using the freight train known as La Bestia. You have many people who fall off, who are maimed, who are killed, and that's why you've been known as the Beast. My job was to try to get to Tabasco, a little town called Tenosique, and follow the route of La Bestia all the way up to the border. So in the first part, we went all the way to Veracruz. So it's Tabasco, the southern states of Mexico, Tabasco, Chiapas, Veracruz, and then we stopped near Mexico City. And it was collecting stories along the way, and one thing that was very clear was that this message that the Obama administration is trying to get out to Central America is sort of working. I mean, there are less people coming. The Mexicans, I think, are trying to play nice with the United States, and so they're doing their job in trying to prevent people from coming. But the bottom line is this is all making the underground, the smuggler operations much, much bigger. We're hearing that smugglers are now charging even more money because any time the U.S. cracks down, the smuggling price goes up. So it's the story with a lot of consequences for people. I mean, it's not necessarily that they're going to stop coming, because I think if you talk to Central Americans, if you talk to officials, you have this political drama playing, but the bottom line is that they're not really tackling the issue as to why people are coming, and that's because of violence, economic disparities, et cetera.
Well, and that seems to be the nexus between both of your reporting is how much these economic disparities ultimately fuel these crises that we get in the media. Let's go to a caller. Let's go to Joseph in Berkeley. Hi, Joseph. Welcome to your call.
Yes, good morning. I have 2 points, and I'll make them relatively brief. First of all, no sooner did I say before Wednesday, that is, that in any controversial police case, unless and until there is independent, objective, cooperating evidence, we must assume that the cops are lying about something critical to the event, if not most of the event. And the next day after I said that, we find that the St. Louis police, who shot someone claiming that his arms were raised, he was coming at them with a knife, he was like inches away, we find that on cell phone video turns up to show that the St. Louis police were lying. He had his arms down by his side. He didn't have a knife in his hand, whether or not he was armed, and he wasn't inches away from the police. You know, we would find the same thing would be true in the Bernal Heights case, where there's going to be a vigil at noon at Bernal Heights at the park there, if there were videotapes. My other point is, you know, I think that the outside agitators angle has been oversimplified, over-enumerated, and overplayed by the media, fed by Officer African American Friendly Ron Johnson, the captain from the Missouri Highway Patrol, who talked a very good PR game by day, but continued much of the same tactics at night as the Ferguson police. And before and during Ron Johnson's arrival, most of the people arrested in Ferguson were either from Ferguson or from St. Louis. So the media has let him get away with this officer friendly tactic that he's been using, and that's the point I want to make. If people follow two excellent sources from Ferguson, at TEFPO, that's at TEFPOE on Twitter, and the other one is a really good female community activist, at Netta, and that's actually spelled N-E-T, followed by 8 A's. And, of course, they can follow Maria Chappelle Nadal, who's a Missouri State Senator who's been very good on this. So that's the point that I wanted to make, that there's a different kind of media spin on this than what's actually true.
Well, thanks very much, Joseph. And let's get a response from Chris.
Well, two things. The second shooting was in the city of St. Louis, and I believe the officers may have used excessive force. There's some evidence to that effect. The police commander, though, the police chief, was immediately on the scene. They got the body off the street respectfully as fast as they had done a crime scene incident report. They initially released everything they had. I believe they made some mistakes because they acted so fast. But they tried to contain it. They tried to at least get the facts out. And now what happens to those police shooters, we don't know. But I want to point out that the police chief of the city, Sam Dotson, he did not send his men to the St. Louis County operation that was the SWAT team operation. He said it was overhanded. He didn't want a part of it. He's been targeted by his police officers ever since because they see him as not letting them go defend one of their fallen. Your caller has a lot of good information, some not so good. The county police does every daily incident reports on who has and hasn't been arrested. All of the violence went down after more than 30 people not from here were arrested. The facts are very clear. Violence went down after people who are not from here were arrested. And we were trying to get them arrested from very early in the process, and they weren't arrested until command was taken away from St. Louis County, and a unified command was put into place that had police intelligence officers on the street trying to locate the folks that were riling up the individuals. Now, if you get riled up and you do something, that's your agency. But if you take someone away who is pushing it into a police confrontation for their own nihilistic ends, then we can get back to the protest movement and what they want to do. Now, if they decide they want to still have some angry confrontation with the police, that's their agency. But as a matter of fact, there were outside actors on the scene, and they were eliminated, and definitely violence did decrease dramatically and almost totally afterwards. Last night there were 8 arrests.
That's Chris King. He's editorial director at the St. Louis American. We're also joined by Alfredo Corchado, who's Mexico bureau chief for the Dallas Morning News. It's our Friday Media Roundtable. On your call, I'm Holly Kernan. You can join our conversation at 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. And Alfredo, one of the things that's interesting about Ferguson and the national and international attention is it's very much a black-white issue and narrative. And as a Latino, as an American living in Mexico, how do you view that aspect of the media coverage and of Ferguson?
I think the first thing that pops into my mind is the impact that that the media cuts have had across the United States.
Hmm.
I mean, Chris brought up a good point. I mean, I don't live in St. Louis. I'm not in Missouri. But I've just been talking to Gil Bailon, the editor at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and he was talking about how, you know, a lot of the cuts that we've seen over the last 8-10 years, many of those cuts have been people of color.
Mm-hmm.
I think when you have an issue like Ferguson, it's a big reminder of the people that we've lost and the people who we need to tell these stories. I mean, we in Mexico, I mean, we had a bureau at one point. We had the largest bureau of any American newspaper, 13 people, staff, writers, TV people. We are now down to 1, and it's my job to try to, you know, convey these very complex stories throughout the region, whether it's Mexico, whether it's the border, whether it's Central America, to an American audience. I mean, we've taken a huge hit, and I think Ferguson reminds you of the importance of having many more minority journalists to cover these stories.
And what about you, Chris? How much are your audiences, which are largely African American, are they interested in the border crisis that's happening right now?
Well, you know, right now, honestly,
I don't mean right now, maybe before August 9th.
Well, it's interesting, you know, there was a study done by a local academic this year that said that increase of immigrants actually creates more economic opportunity for everyone, including African Americans, because of the, you know, the sort of famous entrepreneurial vigor you see. I mean, immigrants tend to be very capable people who have struggled very hard to improve their conditions, and they're not going to stop struggling once they get to the United States. I'm married to an African immigrant who came here under difficult circumstances and has improved her condition and mine. She makes more money than I do. So we very, very hard fought the point that we should embrace immigrants to our region, people that are not black immigrants, because it will actually not compete with our workforce, but actually enlarge it, enlarge opportunity. I believe it's true. And I don't know if people are listening to us, but we are certainly, that's our message.
Chris King is editorial director at the St. Louis American. Alfredo Corchado is Mexico bureau chief for the Dallas Morning News. You're listening to Your Call. It's our Friday Media Roundtable. I'm Holly Kernan, and let's go to Greg in San Francisco. Hi, Greg. Welcome to Your Call.
Yes, I disagree with most of what your panel is saying, in particular, Chris. The reason why African-American men are encountering these violent situations with the police is because, for the most part, they are they are committing the crime. Most of the criminal behavior in this country is generated by this community. And all the stats, any stat that you look at, whether it's city stats or the FBI, which is not very, they're not very good stats, but anything that you look at shows this. And, you know, there's, you know, if you want to make an excuse that they just can't help it because of their, you know, sociological situation, well, you know, you could do that, but I'm not willing to go there and do that and give them.
Greg, why don't Oops, go ahead and stay on the line. Let's have Chris give you a response first.
Well, we're too far away to probably have a conversation. I'm not very interested in it, but I can say this. My staff is about half African-American men, sort of tall, proud, I would say swaggering individuals, very competent and very charismatic. And when this happened, I invited everyone to write about it from their point of view. And I've got an essay by Ishmael Sistrunk, who's our web technician and also writes for us. And I encourage anyone to go to stlamerican.com and search Ishmael Sistrunk, Walking While Black. He writes about it from a middle-class, peaceful, positive African-American male and his experiences with the police. He's never committed any crime to speak of, and he's had a tremendous amount of interference from the police just trying to go about his business, driving a car down the road. That's the kind of thing that drives people out of their mind with rage when they see something like what happened to Michael Brown.
Well, and it's interesting. I think it's important to have a dialogue with people like Greg who probably don't have this experience. And it was interesting to hear the Attorney General of the United States say that he had had experiences of this sort. And he's arguably one of the most powerful men in the country.
Well, you know, I have police officers in my family. As I said, I'm a white man. So I have a cousin and an uncle that are career police officers. And so I know a lot about how they feel. And it is tough work. And you are dealing with criminals. And you certainly are dealing with plenty of black criminals that's in the St. Louis area. And I'm sure, I know for a fact from my family that it's aggravating, debilitating work. Criminals are not the nicest people to deal with, and you deal with them in an adversarial situation that puts you on edge. That's all a fact. I'm very, very sympathetic, and I'm glad there are police officers. I'm not an anarchist, anything but. However, we need diversity training in our police departments. We need proportional representation in our police departments. Ferguson has three police officers that are black out of a crew of 53, and it's a majority black population. If those numbers were different, and if the police officers knew people in their community, I should point this out as well. Ferguson, like many cities, they do not have a residency requirement, so the police officers don't live anywhere near the neighborhoods they police. Officer Wilson, the man who shot and killed Michael Brown, and who's not been charged for the crime. There's a grand jury proceeding now. He lives about 30 miles away in a mostly white, very different kind of neighborhood, part of the county. And that means something. I mean, we need community policing where police officers are genuinely responsive to the needs of the community. And you'd be surprised, you know, most people, I mean, you shouldn't be surprised, but most people don't want to deal with criminals in their neighborhoods. However, if you don't trust the police, you don't cooperate with the police. And if you don't cooperate with the police, you don't convict the criminals.
Let's go to another caller. Let's go to Ariana in San Francisco. Hi, Ariana. Welcome to your call.
Yes, thank you so much for taking my call. I just have a few points about the institutionalized racism in the country, and it's so hard for us to see it. But we have basically a caste system based on race and money, and it's invisible, so the previous caller may not see it. But it's very clear to see, and I feel like what happened in Ferguson is that basically there was a public execution, and the body was displayed and put on show, and it was a means of terrorizing the neighborhood, and the neighborhood reacted accordingly with all kinds of feelings and with all kinds of actions. And then the other thing I wanted to...
Uh-oh, did we lose you, Ariana?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Oh, good,
so
go
the
ahead.
Other thing is that I think we ensure that... certain areas are going to have crime by linking the school systems to the surrounding tax structure, and we ensure that there's going to be intergenerational problems in those communities instead of understanding that we're all one human family and that we have to not include economically in terms of NAFTA, CAFTA, and all those things economically and corporate, but include everyone as our family. And I think that this event in Ferguson also highlights what we do all over the world when we go into neighborhoods, take out military-aged men, kill them in their homes, kill them on the streets, leave their bodies for people to see. And this event is raising some awareness in that area.
Well, thank you.
How are there are military acts all over the world, and this is a form of an internalized military, the police.
Thank you, Ariana, for calling. Let me throw that to you, Alfredo, because it does seem to be that one of the intersections between the stories that you're covering with the cartels in Mexico on the one hand and Ferguson on the other is security, and that we ignore what's happening in Mexico and in places like Ferguson, economic deserts, and are missed at our peril.
Right. I mean, I did an interview this week with an immigration attorney who we were talking about the situation around the world, Central America, and what it means to Americans. And one of the things he said was, you know, the chickens have come home to roost. In meaning that anytime you have U.S. or just any kind of military intervention and you create a mess like it was done in Central America in the 1980s, eventually it'll catch up to you. And next thing you know, you're living in Houston, you're living in Dallas, you're living in St. Louis, and you have people coming in from all over the world who are looking for some kind of status, a way to reinvent themselves, a way to find new opportunities. But Holly, if I can just add something to what Chris was saying, and what the caller was saying, Greg, I just want to remind people, especially Americans, that he was talking about African Americans, but I think if you look at border communities along the U.S.-Mexico border, you have some of the most violent cities on the Mexican side, which is a reflection of lack of rule of law, lack of institutions. But on the U.S. side of the border, you have some of the safest, more secure communities, whether it's McAllen, whether it's Laredo, whether it's El Paso, whether it's San Diego. And it's a reflection that not just the rule of law, but also the people themselves. I mean, people who are just trying to, you know, make a living, find a way to survive. There's been several studies that have been done about immigrant communities throughout the United States and how they are some of the safest, some of the less violent communities throughout the United States.
I guess that's my deeper question, though, both to you, Alfredo, and to you, Chris. Even if I'm living in, say, a gated community across the river from El Paso, and I'm ostensibly safe, or I'm living in Clayton, which is wealthier than Ferguson, and I feel safe, am I ultimately, if there are such deep economic disparities and such deep rage about the economic circumstances, isn't there a bigger question there about what security means?
Well, that's certainly the position we're in here at the St. Louis American moving forward, because we really need to try, both in our newspaper and also in our activism, because we do work closely with police and government officials, our publisher and I, and you know, we need to get people invested in the long-term well-being of the minority community in this region. This problem is not going to go away. We need to diversify our police leadership. We need to implement community policing models, and we need to integrate socially and economically our community. We need to be more invested in each other's lives, or this will happen again, and it won't probably be anything but worse.
And Alfredo, I mean, to you, you mentioned that to some degree the immigrants streaming across the border right now is blowback. We exported a lot of gang members from L.A., refugees from the earlier wars in Central America, who have in a lot of ways spurred some of the chaos that's happening now.
Exactly. I mean, you look at the situation in Honduras, you go to communities and remnants of L.A., remnants of Houston are everywhere. We saw that firsthand in cities like El Paso, even Dallas, San Antonio, Austin, where you had the exodus, not just of the middle class, the wealthy coming in to try to restart their businesses or they bring their money, but also people who are just starting out. So I think eventually, you know, as Americans, you may want to look the other way. You may feel like, you know, this is their problem, this is not our problem. But eventually it catches up to you. There are neighborhoods in Dallas, there are neighborhoods in El Paso that are primarily made up of people who came from Mexico either during the drug war or during the Mexican Revolution of the 1910s. I mean, things eventually come back to haunt you.
And what was striking to me, I'll go to you in just a second, Chris, what was striking to me, Alfredo, in reading your story about the Beast, this big train carrying kids from Central America, they're hopping on top of it, it's very dangerous, up to toward the U.S., was all of the compassion that so many Mexicans were showing these children.
It was incredible. I mean, I was trembling the whole route, and I kept thinking, wow, you know, just bad news after bad news after bad news. just you see the dangers firsthand, and then suddenly you get to this little town in Veracruz, a little town called La Patrona, and you see these women, most of them sisters and cousins and friends, who every day get up in the morning, they all have their routine, their turn. They make something like 300 tortillas, 300 burritos, refill water, refill fruit plates, cakes, and they sit outside, wait for the train, and then they hand the food out to these people who, by now, it's become a legend that if you go through La Patrona, there are very compassionate Mexicans who remember, who know what it's like to see their relatives go to the United States and see the kind of witness or hear about the treatment they get, and that inspires them to try to leave a lasting good memory to the people who are heading for a new life.
And Chris, let's get you in for just a last word here.
Well, I just agree very much with Alfredo said. I mean, you have to take this seriously. It's going to end up at your doorstep eventually, and it's better to address the issue while it's still in someone else's backyard.
And what's giving you hope when you look at what's happened in Ferguson and look sort of down the road at what might be the lasting impact here?
Here's what's given me hope. I was calling people to talk about things, and they say, wait, I'm in a meeting with somebody talking about the same thing. I mean, there's a collective consciousness for change here among the what I call the community of conscience. I'm quite hopeful.
Well, thank you both for joining us. We've been speaking with Chris King, who's editorial director at the St. Louis American. It's the only local African-American newspaper continuously published since 1928 and the longest continuously published weekly newspaper in the St. Louis area. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
And Alfredo Corchado, who's the Mexico bureau chief with the Dallas Morning News. He's the author of Midnight in Mexico, A Reporter's Journey Through a Country's Descent into Darkness. Thank you, Alfredo.
Thank you.
We'll put a link to their articles along with the other articles that we discussed and more information at yourcallradio.org. And I thank you for all of your calls and emails. I apologize that we didn't get to all of them. We will post them at our website, which is yourcallradio.org. And you can continue to post other articles that you think that we should be reading and information and comments there. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. How can photography impact the struggle for human rights around the globe? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with three photographers whose work is part of the UC Berkeley Human Rights Center's exhibit, Envisioning Human Rights, a collection of world-class human rights photography. How effective are images in conveying human rights issues around the world? And how do photographs inspire people to act? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Becca Hoekstra produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.